February 20, 2007. It's a Watt from Pedro show.
home. I'll take the shortcut home. I wanna go home. I'm on my way. These the memories of tonight. Life gems stashed away safely in my pocket.
Watt from Pedro show. Whoa, turn that down. Sorry about that.
Okay.
That was From Brain by Miku, and we start off John Coltrane. Where's my paper? No, that's not the name of the tune. It's I'm a Dreamer, Aren't We All? John Coltrane. February 20, we're on a Tuesday, and it's
Fat
sunny.
Fat Tuesday.
Fat Tuesday. So everybody get all the sinning in for Lent tomorrow. Yeah.
Yeah, your knees indulge
for Hash Wednesday.
Hash Wednesday.
That's Richard Bonney. You heard his voice there.
Richard fucking Bonney, welcome.
We have a visitor from overseas.
Another Irish Catholic boy.
Welcome to Pedro.
Brother Matt, too, he went to seminary school a little bit. But he went to a Jesuit college.
Yeah, you got some Loyola time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I went to a Jesuit. My mom is Italian, so we got to be Catholic.
God bless us all.
Yeah.
God bless us all.
So keep get that hate mail coming. Although, statues probably leap from the wall if I'm in the church.
Yeah.
Like Jerry, Trevitich had me Godfather.
Oh, yeah, wow, you're a godfather. Yeah. Punk meets the godfather.
And so I had to go to Mary Starr for that, and I was sure they were going to leap up and spank the whole beat down on me.
Still to this day, the only church I've ever been in where the Virgin Mary's holding the fishing boat.
She's holding the boat. Yeah. And the other arm's in like a, tribute to Benito Mussolini. Yeah.
But the rest of the statues have their hand out.
Yeah, yeah, right. Palms
the
other way. Palms
up.
All right.
Okay, so enough blasphemy.
Yeah. Well, good.
Some time to hell.
Sepulcher. Burning sepulcher. Right? I met you. It's an interesting story. I found, I'm really into this book Jim Joyce wrote, Ulysses. And I found out there was going to be an Irish production of it, which I thought fitting since he was an Irishman. But he never went back. I think he went back once after he wrote it. But found out it was going to be called Bloom. And because there was a flow going around the internet and looking for music. So I put it out through my flow. And a friend of mine, David Kahn, was hip to it and wrote it. He ended up doing the music for it. So he gets an advanced thing. So me and Raymond Pettibone go up there to look at it. And I was really scared, because it's all lived in my head for all these years since the 20s. There's a lot of double nickel songs written. In fact, there's a song called Shoot 16, which is the day it happened. Pettibone's birthday, too. But I was kind of scared, what's going to... All these things have been words turned into inside my head thoughts, and now someone is going to take a dive and make celluloid visualizations of it. And who ends up being Stephen Dedalus? But Hugh writes me email, and then I go and play there not too long after, I think with Stooges, and I get to meet Hugh. And the first thing I told them was, man, Stephen Dedalus looks so happy. Because my take on the book, the fucking box, was to him always full of dread and shit, thinking about his mind. Just all kinds of burden. Yeah. He seemed to be carrying a heavy weight. through the whole thing. And yeah, so I asked him about his take on it. Although there was some horror moments in your face, but there was a lot of smiles too. I don't know. There was all kinds of scenes in the thing that. But of course, you know, everybody's going to have their own take on a book, and when they make it into a thing. And also, there's a lot of pages, so they couldn't fit it all in, so some of it had to be redacted. But you know, them being Irishmen, and Jim Joyce, Irish writer, in a lot of ways, the book is a celebration of the town of Dublin. So I know they felt that way. You know, sort of like me being on Stooges record. I had this nightmare, this headstone, all it said was fucked up the Stooges record. I want to be buried. I was having this fucking nightmare over. So I know that they weren't being trite, some Hollywood thing, oh, we'll do what we want.
We paid for this.
So, yeah, they went and gave it their best shot. It just, and I ended up liking it too. So great. But Raymond said too, man, what a tough call, because so many people have read that thing. And how'd you get ready for it, Q?
Yeah, well, it was one of the last sort of, it was a last minute thing for me to get involved in it, but I felt really, as you sort of said, it was kind of intimidating because it's such a great story and almost shouldn't really be a film in a way, but it was a riff. I guess it was a riff on a great story.
Ah, that's the word.
What
riff.
They were trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess for me, you know, about finding him happy in it, I just found so much of it really funny. And Stephen Dedalus, even though he's got this terrible burden, as you say, he kind of still is really funny about everything in his black humor sort of way.
Yeah.
And kind of just throwing caution to him and saying, fuck it, you know.
Did you read it before you knew you were going to get it?
Yeah, I'd read most of it before, but it made me go back and read the whole thing.
You know, Italian dudes tell me that when they're in school, they push the Dante on them.
Yeah.
And do they do that?
I was, yeah, but I'm not so much young, but a bit older, you know.
Yeah,
but
right, they, when you can understand.
They, yeah, and they make you read, you know, not make you, but you read Dubliners, the short stories, because that's easier to read, and there's the portrait of the artist as a young man, and a Jesuit.
There's foreshadowing, in fact, because the Stephen's in that.
That's his story, exactly. But the thing for me was that, you know, growing up in a Jesuit school, punk rock was really important to us, because we were, you know, getting through this. Not liking school at all, you know, the usual way.
That was our
escape. And, you know, you'd read The Enemy, which was at the most kind of, I think it was at its highest, maybe for me anyway, when I, as I remember it, it was more like the 80s, 90s, you know, where The Enemy really meant a lot in England and Ireland anyway, that they would break the bands and that they always mentioned the Minutemen. And so we'd be starting to find out more about the Minutemen, because we were all into Dinosaur Jr. and all those guys, the Sonic Youth. But, we, you know, the Minutemen were like, who are these guys? We'd start buying their records. And that was when it really exploded for us, you know. So everyone would write Minutemen on their school notebooks and stuff, and so then when years later, you know, when I get to meet David Kahn, and I said, how did you get involved in this? He said, Mike what? And I said, from the Minutemen. And he's like, yeah. And I said, is there any way I could, you know, just write to him and say how much his music meant to us, you know? And David is a great guy, and he gave me Mike's email address, and I found out Mike was actually online a lot, and you know, with his website and this, and yeah, I know completely. So that was it.
Did you, you saw, like, Double Nickels on the Dime, you heard that?
We'd had that for years,
yeah.
You know.
Did you know that there was a big influence on it?
Joyce, well, I'd read about that, yeah, I had, but I never put two and two.
A lot of cats didn't, man.
Well, June 16th.
A lot of Minutemen things seem to stay internal. We thought was very clear and obvious, and like, even the title of that record, no one got it. It was a total joke on Sammy Hagar, and nobody picked up on that.
Yeah. I'm still learning things off Minutemen albums, and I grew up, you know, and I was there.
You were there.
You were there.
And I'm still learning different doors that...
I met Richard washing pots and pans at the hospital as a teenager.
Great.
We've known each other for 34 years.
So. Yeah, a bunch.
Weird like that, yeah.
So, Hugh came. I know when you saw us at Dublin Castle,
right? Which was an amazing gig, yeah.
Yeah, and it was weather like this.
It was. It was gorgeous
very
weather.
Very typical of Dublin, right?
Yeah, not at all.
Very rare day in Dublin.
It really was. It was really sunny.
It was.
Yeah.
It was righteous. But I had a weird feeling because right before the gig, they told me a lot of cats had been hung in that courtyard.
Wow.
It's not as much as a castle as a set of buildings. Maybe in the older days it was an actual castle. But it has this neat kind of thing. They laid out brickwork to make kind of their
courtyard type thing.
No, there's their designs. They have this thing in the, like an India mandala. Mandala. So Irish have Celtic.
Oh yeah, yeah, Celtic. Yeah.
And they made the court like that. And I guess it was headquarters for occupying governments.
Right. Yeah. It was.
Pointing any fingers, but there's a lot of heavy karma I felt. But I thought in a way maybe. You know, Iggy freaking out there and the Stooges wailing, purge some of that.
Yeah,
exercise. Yeah, exercise.
And then the sun came out.
Yeah.
That sums up the whole day. It was righteous, man. It was righteous weather. Actually, it wasn't my first gig there. The first time I played there was with Jay at the Temple Bar.
Yep.
Yeah. Or by the, in the downtown, right downtown. Well, this was close too. I could walk. Dublin's a town. I saw Hugh again when the centenarian celebration of Bloomsday came. So June 16, 2004. And, you know, the book, you can follow a lot of it. You know, a lot of the stuff is still there. You can walk.
You can do the walk, yeah.
Davy Burns, you know. And then
really? So it's, you can do like a walking tour almost?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's no Turkish baths. There's some things now that are missing because it was 100 years ago. But you can go down by the quays and just walk a lot of them around.
No,
in fact, Hugh met us at the library, outside the library, National Library.
Is that your hometown?
Yeah. Yeah, I still live there, yeah.
And they had a lot of his stuff because Joyce, after Ireland, he was basically living at different people's pads. So they had the suitcase, you know, which was like the most permanent thing he had. Yeah, a couch tour. And more, it wasn't just him. It's him and his family. His son and daughter and Nora Barnacle. Now, she was from Galway. She's from the West, which is a lot of U.S. Irish. I found this out, too. The Dublin people, the East Side, had a little better. So they didn't really have to bail like the West guys do. So the way Europe is, especially in the older days, it can be just a few miles, but it's separated. And so they're kind of different folks, you know, those regions of Ireland.
Was it a racial thing? I mean, was it segregated like... class, pecking order, class?
Well, I guess that was more the north-south thing, really, wasn't it? That was the really political side to things. I mean, I think the west and the east of Ireland are kind of the same religions and all that sort of stuff, so it's not quite, there's not that friction that there has been.
So it wasn't always Protestant Catholic.
Right, that would have been more economic, like you're saying.
I was saying more about the money.
That was
one time Dublin was making more money than London.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
It was.
And what was the major trade? What was generating all the?
There was a lot of farm, you know, within Ireland it's farming, but there was a lot of shipping. But what was really big was Belfast became really a big port, and a lot of the Huguenots, French Huguenots, and people started doing weaving and things in the north.
Right.
And then Belfast became much richer, and then that started to kind of fuel resentment in the south. The Belfast was kind of becoming more, you know, powerful, and they were also Protestant families coming in, and so that started to create the fight between.
There was also an uprising in the late 1700s around our revolution,
right.
And England pulled out some connects, and
that's when there was a lot of land wars, and wasn't it? A lot of rich
absolutely
landowners.
That's right. Yeah, and a lot of English landowners, you know.
Yeah, or bringing in Scottish guys.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah.
So kind of Machiavellian, and you bring in these other.
Yeah, no kidding.
There's some history, like most land.
Yeah.
You know, this last tour I did with Second Man, when I toured my opera, I played Belfast, Dublin, and Cork. And when I went through the border, there wasn't even a stop. You know, so.
Wow.
Yeah, and in fact, the club I played in Belfast had grenades, or was shut down rather than rocket grenades and stuff a few years ago. So some things have calmed down. When I was in court, that's where they found the money from the big bank. I mean, this guy was trying to burn it in his yard.
Yeah.
The big bank. Court was really neat.
He robbed the bank and then he tried to burn the money?
It wasn't he, it was.
A whole bunch of them, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Gangster types. So, you know, maybe a healing kind of thing. Getting along. I was also taken to some of these councils where they paint these big murals. I mean, these are intense things. I mean, so there's just some bad blood, and maybe some things will never heal. But on the other hand, I look at the problems we've had in this land.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and of course, you can't whitewash over them. And there's karma in that sense. But then there's got to be a get beyond thing or nothing. You know, that's what's good about the arts. Because I know Hugh goes to London and does work there. I mean, you know, there comes a point where things have to let go, and it's not like you're co-opting or compromising principles, but in the sake of humanity, if you keep, like Joyce says in the book, history's a nightmare I'm trying to wake up from.
Right.
You know, you've got to be in charge of the day.
Yeah.
In some ways. And
yeah. So we somehow got to learn from.
You would hope.
Madness, you know.
You would
think,
hope.
You would hope, you would think that, you know, that we wouldn't repeat most of the scourge that, you know, we afflict on ourselves. You know. Yeah. I don't know what it is about mankind that makes you want
to
own
worst enemy.
Yeah, it's like we don't.
We have seen the enemy in it. Pogo, remember that comic?
Yeah.
I don't see anything romantic about it.
Yeah,
that's just me personally, but
no, but it can get romanticized.
Yeah, it does get romanticized. Everything does, to an extent. But yeah,
what's
our own worst enemies.
What's the favorite mating call around here? Right, where are you from?
Where are you from?
Yeah, where are you from?
Where are you from?
Then pistoles. Whatever. So I think it's endemic on all of us. And things go through cycles, different lands. If you look at Scandinavians, they call this most civilized place now. But they had periods where they were Viking crazy. And, you know, so reps come and go, but I swear we all take turns at being assholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very indebted to Irish people for producing the culture produced Jim Joyce. A very inspirational thing in my life.
Speaking of Irish, I ate limericks today.
Did you?
In Long Beach. There you go, Sean. Nice corned beef sandwich.
I knew that too.
Now, Hugh, your dad, you come from music.
Right, yeah, my dad. You said you've actually played on the show before,
yeah,
which is a real thrill for me. That's great.
You flowed me some of his music.
I did, yeah. Yeah.
So you had music early in your house.
Sure, he went to study in Vienna, so I grew up the first 2 years of my life in Vienna, and that's where he was studying under a great teacher of his. And then he won an international competition when he was quite young, and he won a piano, and he got some gigs out of it. And so he started touring and playing, and he's played ever since. So that's always been in our life as well, music, yeah.
Cool. So what hipped you to acting?
He kind of, I think he had said, you know, his mum had been quite a, you know, they had a very poor family, and she wanted the best for them despite everything, so she'd send them for these classes, a music class once a week to see if they were any good at music, and maybe like a drama class, the local drama, and they used to do that when he was growing up. And so he did the same to myself and my brother, where he sent us for like a music class and a drama class, and it sort of stuck. We always did music, but then I found I was enjoying drama as well, and got work from that. So I think it was kind of his mum saying, I'm going to have a better life for you guys, in the same, you know, kind of more of a cultured life than anything else. Do you know what I mean? To sort of see what else is out there.
He let you feel out what you felt.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, most, like in my pop, not having any music in his family, music people, I think it's a very iffy, scary field to go into, and something be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Pete Maisich, you know, his parents, mm-hmm. I know, heavy on him for playing, even though they sent him to music school. And he says, something you're going to do on the side. You're going to work at the cat food factory and then go down the docks.
That's exactly it. That's exactly what they were like for my dad. She was sent to the class, but then when he wanted to do it, she's like, no. What are you, crazy?
Not for living,
right? The side mouse.
Well, yeah. My father could not believe, my father was born and raised on a ranch in New Mexico. He couldn't believe that I can get in a van with five other guys and go across the United States and come home with money, my father. He had no conception of it. He had no clue. He knew we were up to something. Grabbing banks, stealing cars. He just could not grasp that I'm not a musician, yet my friends are, and I can get in a van and go across America and come home enough to live for, you know, hopefully till the next tour. So, yeah, man. We're all blue collar, you know?
Yeah,
you know, working class, you know? But that's what, like Walt says, that's what's great about the arts. It gives you that opening to explore, see other worlds.
Exactly.
Yeah, break out of the box, because most people are just trained to get some jobs so that they can pay their bills. And that's, there's no freedom in that.
We know that here, brother. We know people who work on the docks, great job, nothing wrong with it, fantastic work you can get. But they live, work, shop, go to the movies, buy their music.
Take their vacations.
26 miles across Catalina. Like I said, nothing wrong with it. It's great. But
there's options.
There's options.
Yeah.
There's options.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of colors to make a rainbow.
Sure.
You brought some music.
Yes. Yes, Mike.
Play some here. A song you pick.
Okay, I just wanted to play. I came back from San Francisco at the weekend. We were listening to some tunes, and we listened to a lot of California type music, and Creedence made me think of you because of you guys playing that so much and growing up on that. So
you know, they actually weren't a Bayou band; they were California.
They were California.
Very northwest. Bayou.
Northwest.
Very northwest Bayou.
I guess
right by Berkeley.
Berkeley, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess because always the California sound for us is. I mean, I was saying to Brother Matt earlier on, the idea of Pedro from the Minutemen was in our heads in Ireland because it was like this magical place where you guys had talked about, and it was so far away from where we were. It was sunny, and you were by the sea, and you know what I mean. Yeah. It became this magical place. So California is a lot of music is a lot in our hearts.
Oh, I know about California and Europe because, like in the early '80s, when we had another clown in charge, they were putting in nukes, piercings or something. And so there was a little heavy thing. So I would always say, "I'm from California. It'd be no problem." It is a romanticized kind of thing, but it's got some meat.
Yeah, it does.
I love it.
Okay, so let's play some.
This is Creedence, It's Just a Thought.
Getting high. bottle you hold. And I wanna lick you everywhere it is, and everywhere you think. Riley, I wanna hold your hand, I wanna swallow you whole. And I wanna lick you everywhere it is, and everywhere you think. Oh, kick and caboodle in the kitchen sink. Oh, kick and caboodle in the kitchen sink. Is integrated, goes together so well and so on. Well, I'm gonna go on and do my washing.
Thank you. Vaughn from Indiana loves fall. Looking for stability and sexual purity. Marriage a possibility.
Recently divorced, not my fault. No dependents, got a job. Looking for a soulmate or just a roommate. Anything will be great.
Young, tall and handsome from Montenegro. Got a lot of money and a bonus to go along with my house on the Adriatic coast. Big owner and big boner. Not really looking for anybody at all, just showing off, you know.
Thank you.
Watt from Bedro Show. Hugh, that was a song you picked there.
Yeah, it was The Action, who were this kind of quite obscure band from the 60s. I think an English band who recorded this album. They didn't even get to finish it, I think, but George Martin was the producer on it. And then they never got to finish the album, so that's just a sort of a test, but I still think it sounds pretty good.
Wow. So that was Brain by The Action.
Yes, it was.
Before that, we had Culture Shock with Mana Negro HC, maybe Hotcore. That was a band that played up the Stooges in Skopje a couple months ago when I was playing there. And they're great. I think they live up in Seattle, but they're from the Balkans, most of the guys. Bass is Japanese and drummer's U.S. And the bass player flowed me with some of their CDs. I'll be playing more of it. Thank you, Masa. He's a great musician. They all are incredible. And that music, because I think it's a crossroads of a lot of different cultures, they got the weird timings and the Turkish thing and the scales. And before that, we had a band from Italy, Alexander DeLarge, with Gods, Dreams, and Man. Interesting stuff there. And before that, Putanesca with Captain Beefheart cover, Lick My Decals Off, Baby. And that was Joe Bizon, the guitar. Ralphie on the bass. And who's the drummer? I recorded with him. He's on that, the song I did with Henry. On Ball Hugger Tugboat. Damn, what's his name?
Local guy?
No, he's Orange County, but he's a great drummer. Yeah, Wayne Griffin. Sorry, Wayne. Lo siento. Yeah. And of course, Webba, it's her project, and those three guys back her up. And I think they're playing the release thing tonight in Silver Lake. Or Highland Park,
Mr. T's
Bowling Alley. I've played there many times. Mr. T passed away a couple of years ago. Old Sicilian guy. God, he looked great in his old age. Wouldn't guess his age at all. And it was an old bowling alley that they put a curtain in front of the lanes and made gig out of it.
It's a great place.
In fact, one of my bass broke there once. Somebody was helping me and dropped it. And then he says, "Don't worry, I know somebody can fix it." And he took it to a boat ride who'd never even probably seen a bass up close and put all this marine epoxy all in. It helped for a while. But eventually it was glue on glue, so I just had to put a new piece of mahogany in there. It's a little red one. Oh, I'm wearing it. I'm on the cover of Bass Player magazine.
Oh, it came out now?
Yeah, it comes out next month.
Cool.
And
again, how many
sounds
times
like I'm
that what?
Tooting the horn, but it came down to Pedro to take the pictures and talk about stuff I was doing and history and current and future and. And nice cat. It's neat when a bass player talks to you about bass. And then, in fact, they were there to add some stuff to the website. They came up to the Dose gig we played up in San Francisco. In fact, Hugh was there. The gig was over, and he comes up to me, and it's a heart attack. Because the last time I saw him was in Ireland. And here he is at the Hemlock.
I know.
And,
It was great.
Yeah, and so Dose played and they filmed this for their website. So Bass Player Magazine website will have some Dose, and I did some spiel there too.
Cool.
4 to 5. The original spiel. his name is Brian. He was cool people. In fact, he was in a band that played. Remember, I was up there a month ago with Nels and Perkins Banyan? He was in the band right before us.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So I like this idea of blurring lines, you know, journalist, entertainer, you know, no.
Yeah, I guess, several hats.
Like I did an interview with some Australian cats, and they were saying, how do you do this radio show and make a band and, run your Hoot page and, well, you just do. You know, I don't think we should, it's all part of the human thing, you know. It shouldn't be so rigid and
if you had an agenda, you probably wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that's why you trip on in school, you got different subjects.
Right.
It's like, not like that whole life, it all kind of blends together.
That's the way real life is. Yeah. Taking turns in different roles. Well, Shakespeare said life's a stage, you know. We're all playing different roles. And it gets kind of static if things are all fixed. Mm-hmm. And departmentalized, I think that was the school word when I was young.
Yeah, get some different hats.
Yeah. Because you know what? That's what it's about anyway. You know, the illusions and schema, paradigms. Is that the word, paradigm? Paradigm? That we get caught up in and thinking this is the essential reality. And, which is kind of neat about some of the 60s thinking, reevaluating things and just size them up. I don't think that got old-fashioned. Maybe some of the bell bottoms and haircuts, but some of those things, and probably the those iconoclastic God, William Blake, many a couple centuries ago, was asking people to reevaluate. You know, I'm curious, I want to get back to Ulysses because I want to know your take on that book. What did you think about it? Because you know, I was saying in my 20s it was really heavy and what. On me as far as profound, and my take on it then was very celebratory of life thing. It was all this up. And then when I reread it in my 40s, I got a whole nother feel. Now obviously the words stayed the same, I changed, but I sensed in a way it was a very sad book that I never got as a young man. And so I'm curious about your take on it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you can. It's, I suppose when you come to it in your life, it's going to mean different things when you look at it. But for me, what was really fascinating was that Stuart Gilbert book, that the kind of companion to Ulysses, that kind of explained how each chapter had these things. And I mean, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Each
absolutely.
Chapter has a different, you know, organ.
All those things.
Like a little guidebook.
It is, it's a guidebook in a way, but it was written with Joyce's approval. He was alive at the time.
Yeah,
and he sort of explained it for people. So he said every, you know, it's based on the story, you know, the Odyssey. The Odyssey, it's got the same amount of chapters, the same things happen in each chapter as happens in the Odyssey. Like the one-eyed patriot is actually the Cyclops in the Odyssey. And
citizen.
The citizen. So each...
It's Polyphemus.
Exactly.
And there's a Circe, even went and... drew out a schema, which David Kahn went and actually made a thing and gave it to me. I have it as a poster in my pad. And the episodes, because when you're reading it, I mean, it's a very psychological book and it doesn't even have real chapters and things, you know. But if you know Joyce's schema, he's giving actual episode names as from the Homer and, you know, Circe. Golden Ox and the Sun and stuff like this, and there's parallels, but there's also another strange kind of parallel too, this thing about Hamlet and Shakespeare,
the son of the father.
It's funny, there's this like the caddy starts off the book, but he's living with this Buck Mulligan guy. He sees him again in the library, and this is where he's espousing his theory that Hamlet must be Shakespeare's son. And then Mulligan asks him, well, do you really believe that? He goes, no. Which is, there is a great humility in the story, too. Even though it's trying to talk about everything, and what's really neat about it, it all takes place in one day. Because I think he thought it was, that's the fundamental cycle. All the other things are kind of abstract. Mm. Weeks, months, years.
Yeah.
When you get down to it, the sun rises, the sun sets.
You go to a funeral, somebody's born, somebody dies.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So that's the demarcation. And so he puts it, and I actually use that in another record later, the schema part, contemplating
the engine room. Yeah.
Because that's one day. And it my pop's life in the Navy, but actually a metaphor for the life of the Minuteman. So that's why I'm saying that's a profound book on me on a lot of levels.
And it's exciting. It's like it's sort of finding a trick to get into the book again, and it's quite exciting to realize that. And it's like a detective story. You're finding out what it's really about.
Yeah.
You know.
It seems like it wants to be about everything.
Everything.
You know, and it's a trip. I even brought parts of it up again with the second opera. like the first song is called Boylan Blazes, and Blazes Boylan is the lover of Molly. Now that was fever. I was boiling up, but I still
burning up.
I mean, the thing wasn't just a phase in my life. I think it's always going to resonate in me. When I reread it again, because I was going to make the trip, the thing was coming. In fact, I got the Sandy Mount ticket to keep it in my wallet. You know, it's such a trip because here's the physical evidence. You know, I was there. Yeah, Sandy Mount, June 16, 2004.
That's great.
Yeah, I showed it to Sean Lennon and he took it. And I was kind of kvetching over this in my mind, like, should I ask for it back? Because I should be so fucking shit hoarding with materialists. But another way, it was like, God damn, this is giving me all the luck I need. So I did ask him. Because he goes, you know, something about 30, what street he lives on. And Bloom is always going 32 per second per second. Oh, no, but what Sean lives on in New York. At the 32, yeah, number 7 Eccles Street. I seen the door. They only have the door and, like, the thing there in Dublin. But Sean was saying, yeah, you know, because Bloom's always going over little things. He's always thinking. And so, for some reason, like, the law of gravity, the acceleration of gravity keeps going through his mind 32 feet per second. And so Sean, like, and I was like, whoa, that was pretty interesting, because a lot of young people, or even my age or whatever, they don't bring up things from that book so much, you know. So that was kind of neat, but I did take back the ticket. And then I've had almost regrets about it later, you know, like, maybe I should send this back to him. Because I took it out to show him, you know, when he said that. And so maybe it looked like I was actually here, Sean. No, I'm passing the baton. No, Indian Gary. You know,
giving it to you.
Yeah, so maybe it's not a big deal, but I had kind of a crisis over it. Oh, you think any other movies people are going to make another stab at it?
God, I don't know. You know, I mean, it's crazy I'm going to do
it
in the first place.
It was the Orson Welles thing where he did the opera thing in the whorehouse.
Oh, did he really? He did
a little short.
He did a bit of that, wow.
And that's the real...
crazy stuff, yeah.
Right, it was handled pretty trippy in the Bloom movie. Because it's really weird. It's almost id stuff. And...
Night 10.
Men, maybe where men are really afraid, really insecure, and it's a really bizarre kind of scene. Like, he's on trial for being a perv in his mind. But actually, it's because he's a Jewish guy living, a Jewish heritage guy living in Dublin, and his whole people are up on trial. But he's on trial for being a perv in a park. Really wasn't, but I think he's feeling guilt over the letters he's been writing to. There's a lot of shit going on. Yeah, read it for a minute. I'd like to know your take on it.
I started tripping on it when I was down in Venezuela. I tripped on the whole languaging of it, the way that, I guess that's when you're talking about the parallelism, just the way you use his words. Like, this one thing I remember, he said something like, they rolled the barrels out as the barrels rolled out, or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that.
And he was heavy into music. In fact, there's some recordings of him singing. And, there's been a lot of books written on that Pettibone King, you know, like 50 or 60 books every time. And they're all old, beat-up ones from second-hand, where people... The one that really struck me was this one. I can't remember the author's name. I was trying to think of it, but it was called On the Liffey. Liffey's the big river in town. And in Finnegan's Wake, the book he wrote after, that kind of is a symbol for infinity. It starts with that river and it ends. So it's like the book don't end. Again. And there's some old Irish story about a guy who got so drunk, they thought he was dead, but he just conked. So he actually rises at his wake, because he wasn't dead, but it's kind of resurrection.
The bell
Pharaoh ringer. Going back to Egypt, maybe. Kind of
the
thing.
Bell ringer.
Oh, right. There's people with bells, so I'm like, oops.
The graveyard shift. That's where the graveyard shift
that's
came.
Yeah,
catch the bell ringers.
All right, we're at the end of first hour of Watt the Beatles Show, February 20, 2007. Hang tight for Act 2. February 20, 2007. It's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Frankie Deirdre, 20-year-old Frankie. He's married, he's got a kid, and he's working in a factory. He's working from 7 to 5. He's just trying to survive. Well, let's hear it for Frankie. Frankie, Frankie. Frankie can't make it, 'cause things are just too hard. Frankie can't make enough money. Frankie can't buy enough food. And Frankie's getting evicted. Oh, it's here for Frankie. Oh, Frankie, Frankie. Oh, Frankie, Frankie. Frankie is so desperate, he's gonna kill his wife and kid. Frankie's gonna kill his kid. Frankie, pick up a gun. Pointed at the 6-month-old kid in the crib. Oh, Frankie. Frankie looked at his wife. Shut up. Frankie with a gun to his head. Frankie's dead.
like he's lying on cover.
Dr. Pedro show. That was a song Hugh picked called Tres Cosas by Juana Molina. Can I tell you something about that?
I saw her play in Dublin recently, and she was just on her own. Like you said, she jammed a Kano, and she did a really good gig. So it's quite electronic, strange music, but it's beautiful.
And she's from...
Spain. I think she used to be an actress, actually, and she was well known in Spain and decided to go back to music.
Who's the Spanish actress? Well, no, it's Ava Gardner. She's playing a Spanish. I'm trying to think of that movie.
Night of the Iguana or something, yeah.
Night of Iguanas with...
Was that her?
She's,
yeah.
It's a Latin thing.
Yeah.
Cause I think she ended up living in Spain some, but it's Mexico, and Richard Burton is like some... priest.
I think that's it. Yeah. Or it's
but
one
the
of those.
I'm talking about is she's an actress that gets discovered. It's Humphrey Bogart is the director that's been drinking a lot, and the only gig he can get is to work for this bullshit producer.
In a Lonely Place?
And Ava Gardner is this young actress in Spain and that gets discovered, and like, you know, God damn, I can't remember. Terrible. I love Bogey. He's one of my favorite actors, and I try to see all his movies, and re-see him because my memory's so bad. I have to rediscover them. You know, a lot of movies I can't see twice, but I can with Bogey. Man, I'm way into him. I don't know why, but there's something about him. Yeah. All right.
He is that cool now.
And I like, he also, I've read books about him, and he took on the business and became the first independent producer after, I mean, it started out that way with Chaplin and Fairbanks and Pickford and
right,
ours.
Right.
But then it went to this stable system with the big moguls, and he named his company after his sailboat, Santana.
He used to have some Pedro time, didn't he? Have one of
that's right. That's right. Yeah, the Hollywood Gables, I think they call it. Is it by Rancho? That's where the bungalows were. Cats used to come down here.
Yeah, some of these pads just down the street, like where Dirk's at and stuff.
In there too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different times. I wish I could go back to the old Peter, but you know what? It's probably very heavy in some ways, so it's okay to go back. It's okay. I'm in the moment. What? Oh, yeah, we started off the second hour with Frankie Teardrop by Suicide. It used to scare me big time. It still does. That is a heavy song, and that was a strange band. It's from their first album. And Thurston used to get to see him in the day. So I always pick his mind about those experiences. I had him on... I had to do it over the phone, but we're talking.
It was an interview with him, yeah. Yeah.
He's on tour right now. I asked him for some advice. Stooges people asked me for, who to get for opening acts because the tour is coming, you know. So I asked Thurston and he suggested some bands, so we'll see how it goes.
Cool, so different region, different local.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And his tickets went on, so all the pre sale sold out, so. I think we're here on the 23rd at Wiltern in L.A.
Oh,
it starts in Boston, I believe.
So it hasn't gone for sale yet.
Yeah, oh, so yeah. Pre-sale did. Yeah, so that's a neat pad. It's an
yeah,
old deco
cool.
thing on the Miracle Mile.
Yeah, cool spot.
Wilshire corridor trip. Yeah, they were going to tear it down.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but it got saved.
Yeah, that's classic.
Yeah, I saw James Brown there. Bootsy came. I remember... Bootsy showed up, and he had a cape on, and on the back of the cape it said, "Yeah, it's me." And he didn't play anything. He just spun around. And he went, "Hey, whoa!" Or maybe Jim, Mr. Brown asked him to, exit stage starboard. It's my, game. But that was a trip. Me and Raymond saw him. Wow. Now is my extreme pleasure, honor, privilege to bring you Brother Matt Spin Cycle.
Thank you. You're going to get two little fat Tuesday load for starters.
All right.
same old stories and the same old lies. Used to love her, but it's all over now. Yeah, I used to love her, but it's all over now. Oh,
but it's all over now. They were all amazed and were Ever had. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd be slamming and jamming today. If it weren't for bad luck, I'd be slamming and jamming today. Seem like hard times and trouble sure enough come my way. Coming my way.
Let's go.
Cowboy from Pedro show. Whoa there, cowboy. That was a fall with something new. In fact, the record's called, let me look at it here. Wait. It's called The Real New Fall LP. And that song was Green Eyed. If it sounds like I'm chowing, it is because I am. But Matt fixed me some righteous jambalaya. Very happy. In fact, I might have probably get another fucking bucket full.
Cool. Bonton Roulette. Yep.
Before that, we got a song that you picked. Daisy Glaze. Yeah, Glaze is Pedro slang for twin teeth. By Big Star. Want to say something about that?
Just another great, great sort of American sound for me. I don't know.
We're at the end of the second hour, February 20, 2007. Beaver Show, hold tight for hour three. February 20th, 2007. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show, and here's part six. Jack Flanders in the Ghost Island. Jack.
So Bunny is on an island that has disappeared?
Probably.
And you are doing nothing?
What do you think we were just doing?
Talking. How about some action?
Okay. What?
Claudine, you say she knows, so ask her.
Look, Claudine tells me absolutely...
nothing.
Right.
Smart woman.
Well, in this case, I don't know about that.
Why don't you know?
I don't think she can handle this.
Did she tell you?
She tells me absolutely...
nothing.
Not right. Did we just step into a loop?
Are you feeling loopy?
Aren't you?
No.
Never?
I just am.
Always?
Of course.
Maybe we have more in common than I thought.
And we are friends? We trust each other, yes?
Well, I don't know if we have that much in common.
I can live with that. Go find Claudine.
I promised I would never interfere with what you're doing, or even ask the purpose of this voyage we've embarked on, but something is happening that I have the feeling you can't handle this alone.
You might be right.
Well, can I help?
No. Please, I need your understanding.
I just wish I knew what to understand.
Jack, if I bring you into this, it may cause more problems.
Well, probably, but what about Bunny?
I feel she is safe.
Okay.
I was in the Pelican's pouch talking to Joseph, and I felt something change. It got real quiet. The music stopped. I could hear the flies buzzing around. And then, even the flies stopped. I noticed that Joseph had poured a bourbon and set it down on the bar, and then stepped back and was watching it.
He was expecting something to happen?
He was making an offering.
To those that bless us.
That's what I was thinking.
But you didn't see anything.
I did. I felt something, but I couldn't see it. Not looking straight on. I turned my head away and checked out things by looking through the corners of my eyes. That's when you can see the spooks.
You saw it?
I saw something. It was almost transparent, but fuzzy. It's hard to focus on something when you're looking out the corner of your eye.
It was some sort of entity?
It was a fuzzy blob, like Bunny said, shaped like a cocoon, floating above the floor. And then it was gone. The flies started buzzing again. The music came back, and Joseph drank the bourbon.
Did you ask Joseph about it?
No, it didn't feel right.
You know, I've been noticing around town, there's more and more little shrines and offerings.
Yeah, there's a lot of free lunches out there.
It's tempting, isn't it?
Especially them fried chicken legs.
Early the next morning, and I mean early, it was still dark, Ojo and I took a dinghy we had borrowed from Fast Freddy and headed out of the harbor. We hoped to be somewhere close to where the islands might appear, if they appeared. And we just sat there, bobbing up and down, waiting.
I should have brought my iPod.
Oh, Joe, you have an iPod?
Doesn't everyone?
I thought you'd have a boombox.
I used to have a boombox. It was about the size of this boat.
Well, they've gotten smaller.
Everything has, except SUVs.
Yeah. Did you know that...
What?
Behind you.
What's there? Whoa! Where did that come from?
Start this thing up. Let's get going. Oh, no. Don't tell me it's not going to start.
Come on.
Oh, come on. Fast, Freddy assured me this motor is in tip-top shape.
I think it's bloody.
Man the oars. Time's a waste.
Aye, aye, my captain. Do you think these islands ever appear anywhere else?
You mean like China?
I was thinking more like off the coast of Borneo.
Let's hope we don't find out.
Hey, this Spook Island's looking pretty solid to me.
I don't know. It seems a little shimmery.
Palm trees, white sand, soft surf. That's real enough for Mojo.
Hey, that little beach over there. It looks like a good place to land.
Okay, heave to.
Well, up close, it seems pretty real.
There's nothing ghost-like about this.
Okay. You first.
Why me?
Well, in case there's cannibals.
Oh. So they'll eat me first?
Oh, no. They may think you're one of their own.
The old Ooga Booga, huh? I think he just wants me to step out to see if I'm going to sink.
But you just said it looks real enough for Mojo.
There's something about this place.
Mojo, you gonna hop out or not?
Look, when we're on the island, what happens when it disappears?
We'll find out.
Is it just me, or is this island changing?
It's getting light out. Come on, move it.
Aye. One small step for Mojo, one big step for... Whoa!
I guess it wasn't solid after all.
Hey, man, give me a hand.
Okay, come on.
Here you go.
Shelter for me.
what from Pedro's show with the monitor on so you get the echo. That was Nels Klein with Destroy All Nels Klein, the band he had with five guitars.
That was great.
I don't think they had a drummer either.
That was awesome.
I think Bob was on bass. Yeah, Bob Mayer was on bass. But G. Stinson, Nels Klein, Carla Bozulich, Woody Aplanop. His name is hard. Aplanop. It's hard to say. He's a cool cat. I've played Woody. Stuff before. Woody, yeah. He's got the band Papa Woody. There's drums. It's his fucking twin brother, Alex, of course. Sorry, Alex. I just recorded with Nels and Chad Sunday. The Western Cult.
Yeah. Cool.
In Malibu, in a scary ass roads there, you know, they go to one lane and these. God damn. Beautiful view, though, once you got there. Had to go straight from the airport in San Francisco. Before Nels, we had something you picked, Dad Steps by The Natural History.
That's for me, Tear It Up.
Got the bone phone going there. Part 6 of Jack Flanders and the Ghost Islands. Okay, Hugh, I want to ask you about acting stuff, because I don't have a lot of acting people on the show. And you're doing script writing now. And tell me the difference between it.
I guess it's a bit like maybe recording other people's songs, or maybe trying to get your own songs made too, is kind of the fun of doing the screenwriting, because you get to kind of have a bit of control, whereas as an actor, obviously, you're pretty much a hired gun, you know, which can be great as well, but sometimes you want to...
Actually, you even have a director.
Yeah, exactly. With a large cattle prod. Yeah. So I guess the writing stage is where everything still hasn't been fucked up yet. So yeah. Everything's...
There's probably frustration with that, right?
Yeah.
When it gets down to the set.
Yeah, of course. But I guess you have that initial bit where everything's perfect, and
you
kind of, it's up to you what you're going to make.
Rewrite.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard, like, Gone with the Wind. I mean, some big movies were rewritten.
Completely. So the writing is great fun for me. And
Faulkner did some writing for Chandler, and even that stuff got, you know, great writers
that's
like
right.
that.
That's right, Fitzgerald, and yeah.
Yeah, I trip on, you put all this time, and then hundreds of pages get tossed.
Yeah.
You went in a different direction than you wanted to go.
And also there's a trend, too, to get an ending that the audience is going to like, so you scream different versions.
Sure, yeah.
In front of test audiences. Okay, we'll go with that one. Yeah. I first heard about that with Brazil, right? It didn't have the ending they actually... his name?
Terry Gilliam. Terry, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
The U.S. guy in the Python.
Yeah,
it wasn't his choice, but the guys with the money, you know. And we were talking about this while music was playing. They got so much money riding on these things. I actually know somebody who knows somebody who sold a script, but never got made. But they made all kinds of money on it.
People make their... I think they spend their whole lives sometimes. You know, you can be in development or sell scripts and never have anything actually made. But, you grow old and die. Yeah.
That's a bizarre business. What about the business? I mean, because you've been in Ireland.
Yeah.
And some London. And now you come to Cali. You come to the heart of the thing. The machine. And what's your impression?
Well, I think... what I've found is that everybody can be really positive over here, and they give you a fair chance, because, I mean, sometimes in Europe they can be a little bit snooty, and kind of judging you maybe in some ways. And I think everywhere in America, maybe you're given a fair shot, and they're like, come in, we're going to read your stuff, see if we like it or not, and they give you a fair chance. And I think that's a great thing about America, is that they really do give you a chance, and everybody's an open book. You know, we're not going to judge you until you screw things up. You know, and then we'll never talk to you again. That's kind of up to you, you know. So I've been really... I mean, everyone's been really positive to us, so I've nothing... No bad experiences yet, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Acting-wise, of course, it's different, you know, and you can... There can be good and bad things to that, too, but...
Well, everything human's probably going to be mixed up everywhere you go.
Exactly.
Right. Probably has a lot to do with the people you're working with.
Yeah.
How they carry themselves and so.
But, you know, the acting is great because you can do different things, whereas, like, last year I was doing a Jane Austen thing for English TV, which was Northanger Abbey, one of her first books.
Oh, yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, quite posh, and we're speaking in an English accent, and it's all very, you know, quite proper. And then I went and did, like, a zombie movie just now with Faye Dunaway in Wales, which was me talking like that as a zombie. And, you know, Faye Dunaway going, what the hell is this kid doing? But anyway, so, you know, you get to mix it up, which is great as an actor. You know, you're going from one type of film to another, and I love horror movies, so that was fun for me. But then to do something that's quite, you know, posh.
Why is she doing that?
she liked the script, Mike.
Yeah.
But she was great. I mean, she was, you know, she's a legend in her own.
Oh, yeah,
in her own right.
She messed up Barfly though. Well, Rourke messed it up more.
I never
Linda,
got to
you
see
know,
it.
Bukowski's wife lives here.
Of course, in Pedro.
Right. Actually, came to the second man gig. She called me, I got home, you know, put my gear up, and the phone rings, it's Linda, and she's saying, oh, man, you guys are playing great. This is this long showman. She goes, I know, I'm into it. It's wild, you know.
Cool.
Yeah, very nice, but she told me that Bukowski was kind of bumming on their take, but, you know, the interpretation.
Yeah.
He's not even... Right, they're taking a book and then script and then...
Right, exactly.
So all the layers. Yeah, it's a trip. That thing about Raymond, he's got his paper and his pen, and he, all by himself he has to do this thing, and then put it, hang it, and people judge it then. But us, me to some extent, you to an even larger extent, goes through all these filtering of people process. So folks are giving you an open shot to just throw your stuff out. That's happening. You know, sort of like the dream, the charade they parade at this the South by Southwest. You know, come on, kids, come play. You know, come drive down from Anchorage, and you might get signed. Right. You know, so it's not all like that.
No.
You've met some great situations and stuff.
You can't win if you don't play.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're not in. Yeah.
Or your uncle. That's the fifth remake of Peyton Place. See, that's true. I mean, I don't know any scriptwriters, but I know people who know, and they say it's hard to get original things in there. And maybe this goes back to the money thing we're talking about. So much money's riding on these things. They want, they can't lose.
That's right.
They can't afford to lose. So if the thing is too original, but then you think of what's his name? Charlie
Kaufman?
Kaufman.
Yeah, Kaufman.
Malkovich. That was a wild one. I can imagine him bringing that one in.
Of course, and then when that's successful, everyone goes, give me something like that.
Right.
And he's like, nobody ever wanted to do it until I broke that through.
Right.
Yeah.
And then even the other one, the one he did after that about the orchid, Spike told me about it. It was actually going to be about an orchid.
Adaptation, right.
But adaptation, it ends up being about trying to do
a movie about, yeah.
Yeah, and Hollywood loves movies about movies. That's, what a thing. When I do my engine room opera, I would talk to the boss from the top of the IT team. I want to do an opera about three guys in a boat. You know, he looked at me, you know, and he doesn't blink. But he was, all right, do it. That was a fucking happening thing. He had a brother who drives a truck. We talked about that for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, because you have all these ideas about how it is going. And maybe like I was telling you about touring, before me and D. Boone toured, all we would read in the interviews with the rock stars was how what a nightmare. And then when we actually did it, we loved it because it was not a burden, it was a B word, it was an O word, opportunity, it was fucking righteous. So that's why I'm curious, I ask you about it. What about getting it together, right? Because you collaborate. What's that like?
Right, well, that, I mean, for me...
You mean by committee? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds crazy, but for me, I find the film is very collaborative anyway. You know, right. You're always around people... It's not just you playing music, maybe, or something, you know, or Raymond painting, you know. It is a group thing. So the more opinions, sometimes it can help. And I know for me, writing anyway with my friend John, we bounce ideas off each other. Another way, you guys
come up with a scene.
Yeah, and
where can this lead to?
Exactly,
where can you see this lead?
And if you hadn't said that, I wouldn't have thought of this. And
right,
you know,
right.
The usual way that can work. So, and again, acting is something that you don't really collaborate as much on. You're doing your own lines, you know, your own part, and you are obviously collaborating, but not quite in the same way. So
yeah.
That's the fun of that part of it.
Yeah. There was that movie, me and my mom were chatting with Yuka, and we were talking about, but of course my mother has to talk about this Japanese movie, but they use Chinese actresses. And so, yeah, Yuka says, yeah, I could see how the kimono was folded wrong and the collar and this. But, I was thinking, well, what if the part called for Martians? You know, you find a real Martian.
Right.
I mean, it's acting, right? Playing parts. Shakespeare days, he had boys playing the women.
Yeah.
Shakespeare never went to Denmark. Yeah, but he still writes.
Right,
yeah.
And it's the whole thing. So keeping it real. Or John Fogerty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or on the bayou, yeah, very northwest bayou. So,
but then you say, you know, as you said, when they told you guys you should move from Pedro because, you know, if you're going to make it, and then what you're saying, what would we write about, you know?
Yeah.
So
it's a weird trip.
Yeah.
Because art is to transcend reality, but then there's this, you can tell there's a hankering for people for this authenticity. Look, I'll tell you what bugged me was with the Sid and Nancy, right? And his shirt, he's not wearing a swastika, they have another thing. Why, you know? I know, but if somebody else didn't know, maybe that means nothing to the fucking movie, you know, the spirit of it or whatever. But, like, there's going to be a Darby movie, and Paul and Helen, who were his good friends, are involved with it and stuff, but you're wondering how much is going to get airbrushed. But for you, just getting a script accepted would be good enough.
Yeah, completely.
And then you let it go.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
they can screw it all they want. Yeah,
fold it up in an airplane.
But the guy who I do write with is a really good director, so the idea would be that he would direct the scripts, you know, so maybe there'd be some control there. And obviously he said himself, if they really want to do it without him as a director, he'll kind of, you know, step aside if he has to. But
do the directors have all the control?
I guess they, you know, what's weird these days is the casting is so important, almost more than anything else. Like, if you can get a star in your film, then the film will happen.
Okay.
More than anything, even more than a director these days, or a producer or anything like that. It's if you can get, you know,
producers actually put it together.
They put it together. Yeah. It's all about the Benjamins.
I can see that, Bobby De Niro. Yeah, that's an actor I like. I was telling you, I love Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah.
And stuff, but that's one cat I like, and he's filmed the Raging Bull part. Jake LaMotta thing here at Peter.
Oh, was that some of that
waters? It's called La Zona Rosa Numero Dos now, but
yeah. He did another movie with Al Pacino on the dock.
Okay.
That's right. What was that called?
Is that Heat?
Heat.
Yeah.
Not too old.
He was one of my, he still is one of my main heroes, obviously.
Yeah. It looks like he gets into his parts.
Yeah.
Like, I read somewhere he taught himself saxophone for New York.
Which is a great movie, I think, yeah.
Yeah, early on, too.
Mm.
And the Bang the Drum, baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, some of the early ones happened. Some of his, what seems like I noticed he's been doing is like he don't want to have his own movie. He's coached with people. I wonder if that's his choice.
You could probably choose.
Because you were saying casting's a big thing.
Sure.
Bobby De Niro can't have his own movie. I can't believe that.
I think he's just brought out this film, isn't he? He directed it, and he's in it as well, called The Good Shepherd, about the CIA. So the birth of the CIA with Matt Damon. And I think that's been his big passion for the last few years. That's just come out now. So I guess he's interested in directing.
Okay.
As well.
So the way he did it was do it.
And get himself in it, and
right.
Matt Damon, right.
My baby.
Yeah.
I'm riding. I'm holding a reins. I'm riding shotgun. Because, God, he's such a massive actor. I just don't know how those things work. How we... Obviously, people vote somehow by buying the DVD or going to the
theater.
Sure.
You know, who gets
college. There's
shots.
A funny way though, like I've heard of, you know, a couple of people who've worked with him, and you know, you always sort of want to find out how these guys work, and
yeah.
I've worked with a good director as well, and what they often, he likes to do is, it's kind of like riffing in music where he'll do a take and he won't want them to cut, he'll just do the take, he'll pause, he'll do it again, he'll do it his own way, he'll do the line a couple of different ways, and it's like, you got it in there.
Wow.
Yeah, and
so
it's
some editing.
Yeah, it's almost like it's his own way of riffing, you know what I mean,
in
a sense. And if you cut every time between a take,
yeah.
you lose all the spontaneity and what you've just been getting from the take or whatever, and things fall over and the lighting and they come into your makeup and then you've forgotten what you were thinking anyway, you know. So
he's
kind of keeping the moment fresh.
I've done a couple of movies with Raymond. Maybe a little different. But I got really scared to do this shit. Do you get scared?
You get scared.
Yeah, fuck. My legs would be trembling. The other big dealio is remembering. Does everybody remember, or do some motherfuckers? Because what me and Raymond did, we fucking taped shit on the wall.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah, you can actually see some of this shit on the wall. But the object was trying to get an angle. You know about our new thing with Richard. Yeah, we're going to do a Richard II. A film version, and now we've come up with this another twist on it, because Gomez, a Spanish arts friend of us, we want to play Bolingbro. I'm going to be Richard, of course. And the 500-year-old English is a little tough. I love the accent, I mean, the thick Spanish accent.
You can do it. I've heard you do English.
Well, maybe I could do, but it would be really tough for Gomez. So I was thinking of stay in spirit to every fucking scene. I mean, as much as we can. We're not in his day, so it's hard to exactly know. But change the kingdom to a band. Now, you know, the plot is King's unfit to rule. He's got to go. He's fucked up with the rules of heredity. I was telling you this in the club last night, huh? I saw Christian's cousin playing. He's the bass on a synthesizer. Were trippy, but I was thinking, you know, illegitimate ruler, bass player's the leader of the band, he's got to go, so we're just going to trade the band, the kingdom for the band,
yeah.
And king for bass player, and Bolingbroke is going to be the lead guitar player, and of course, you know, the natural order of things, he's got to
get rid of the bass player.
Yeah. God, he's got to go. And in fact, because the whole play is hand-wringing on Richard. He knows he's got to go. He's too hardy, too dreamy, but not fit to rule. You know, the politics of that play. You were talking to somebody, they didn't even know about it. Everyone knows Richard III.
Right, of course.
But it got put on at a time that was really weird, because Essex was trying his coup. And it's, you know, unfit ruler, and it's Elizabeth's in the Gloriana days, and no heir. It's a pretty trippy thing. And Raymond's, he's always been supportive of my crazy whim, so, in fact, he's way into it. And we'll change the language, everything to fit this contemporary thing, but not just springboard off him. The issues in the scenes, you take away whatever circumstance they were. They were doing a history play. Actually, it's not about the late 1500s, early 1600s. It's 300-400 years before. So he was. I want to do the same thing with our spiel, our slang or whatever.
Great.
Our thing. But stay spit to those issues, because the righteous thing about Shakespeare is his shit is universal. And the trip, him coming from a glove maker, him not coming from the upper, and he did stuff that everybody could get into. The groundling with the pennies.
Yeah.
And the dudes up in the box. And obviously he had a patron, maybe Elizabeth herself, because to get these things done.
Right.
When I started getting into this, I didn't know much about that time, so I started reading a lot about it. And the theater did not have much respect in them days. Government churches all tried to shut it down all the time. They even had to build the things on the south part of the river. It's a couple on the other side, but it's heavy. And in fact, when Cromwell comes, he shuts them down, and they don't come back 40, 15 years or so. So it was kind of risky. It was kind of punk for those guys.
Definitely punk, yeah.
You know, and they came out of weird tradition, too, like mystery plays. And these traveling guys, because people couldn't read, so they're teaching Bible shit in plays. And everybody wanted to be Judas.
But you're right, it was like a gig where people were like screaming at the characters. And
yeah, intense.
Yeah.
Intense. So I want to give them respect, even though we're going to do an adaptation in a way. But it's an interesting thing. And doing anything creative with Raymond is a mind blow. He's righteous. I made three with him. One with about one Weather Underground, one about a punk band in the 70s, and one about the Jim Morrison. That was like 4 hours long. Leather pants. And I ended up in a bathtub in leather pants. But then I'm a ghost. I don't actually totally die. You know? It's called Red Tide Rising, Venice or Mars. Well, look what I did. I hijacked your fucking spiel to talk about myself. It's terrible. Sorry, Hugh.
Do you remember, Mike, talking about the Sand Pebbles, that
yeah.
movie that you guys went to see when you were young?
Favorite movie.
That's right. Yeah.
Gotta read the book. When you come to town next week for the tour, I got a couple paperbacks.
I'd love to.
No, Sailor wrote it. Big word. That thing is intense. Steve McQueen, I liked him.
Yeah.
He was a trip. He had a certain kind of focus. That was trippy.
I saw that Peckinpah
film.
You know,
it would draw you in. There was something about him, like De Niro, like Bogart. Maybe just for Watt. I don't know what it is. But man, those cats, they draw you in. It's not like they're fucking goofing in front of a mirror or a pandering yuck. They bring you into the world, into that world, in that moment. It's heavy. It's almost I won't say it's like sound manipulate, you know, like a lot, nowadays there's a lot of fast editing, cut. I feel like it's manipulating me. This shit is different. This brings it's actually like saying it's okay, but not on. It's okay to come on in. How are you going to bring yourself into this? But it's not beguiling. You know, it's a trip. The guy, he's in his art. Maybe it's like seeing a gig where you get drawn into the performance of a guy playing his bass or something. It just draws you in to just the endeavor of it. I forget if it's even a scene or if it's movie or whatever. I'm just drawn into the act of it getting done. It's a trip about that. It can happen with camera work too. There's a whole thing to it. It's pretty incredible medium, and that's probably maybe why I get bummed and a little pessimistic about it.
Yeah,
because it seems as like such can be done with
yeah.
it, because it has.
Right.
When that and in Brazil, I cried so fucking hard. They're in his brain.
But he's happy. He's happy.
Fox, that's his mom.
Yeah.
Fuck. That samurai thing, that's a fucking scalp. That was heavy. That was heavy. That was fucked up. Anyway, we don't want to. I love Nels Klein, but we should probably play something else. Another thing, yeah. Spot from Peter Show.
It takes a man. Thank you.
Bob from Pedro Show. I'm giving my own interview here. Sorry about that. Yeah, that was Now with It's So. And before that was I Am Robot and Proud with, that's a name.
Yeah.
Maybe Highliner. iRobot, that was iRobot. Wasn't too much in it. The electricity is in your house. No, the electricity in your house wants to sing. It's a long song, kind of like a long band. Beautiful music, though. Probably good hair. Oh, my hair. Folks out there. And Bullshit before that with You Are a Song. Yeah, Yumi Cramping. And we started with Menfolk. With Hell is in Text. Now, we're laughing because this is a band from Denmark. Hell is in Texas. Probably a lot of things in Texas. Big. I don't know if you've ever driven. It's 880 miles across. Yeah.
The train across. That's a couple days.
Damn. There's a lot of stuff in Texas. Or at least you can fit a lot of stuff in there. And the menfolk, they're into it, huh? That's a trip. Go Danes. My pop's mother was Danish. Lorenzen's. Some of us moved to Pedro. Some of us stayed there and made punk band. Sing about Texas. Hugh, thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's been such an honor.
Yeah. Nice to have you.
Yeah.
Truly righteous. You're my first acting man to be on my show. Usually I have music people, but so thanks for giving the insights and the great songs you played. And I know you wanted to come to Pedro.
I've always wanted to. This has been a real fulfillment of a dream.
Next week I'll give you a tour during the daytime.
Great, you're on.
That won't be for the radio here. You can't just imagine if you heard a bunch of Minuteman songs and then one of those idiots was going to show you around the town he lives in. It's kind of what it's going to be like. Or something. But I love it, man. I've given a lot of tours to Beaver. I love it.
I'm looking forward to it.
I kind of relive all the things and stuff without being too gooey sentimental because I'm, turning somebody on to the thing. And your town's great too, man. I know I'm going to come back there in the beginning of September.
That's great.
So maybe you can take me around again.
You got it.
That would be righteous. And you'll probably be coming back and stuff.
I hope so, Mike. Yeah. I'll shoot by again. Cool. It would be a pleasure.
Cool. Absolute. And Brother Matt, thank you for all the
aiding
and abetting that you did. The righteous jambalaya.
Oh, cool.
God damn.
Cool.
And I'm fat. Worthy of a fat dude. Way worthy. More than one.
Cool.
And back next week. Probably last show for a little because I've got some of my gigs. Stooges in Europe. And I'll be back tonight. Yeah, so that week won't be gone. But next week we'll have a show. My send off one. And some dose gigs coming up. Three in a row. Tomorrow in Long Beach, do Piazzas, the Writer's Garage. Monday, we're playing live on littleradio.com, another internet station, but a great one. Bobby Yalt had me on a couple weeks ago, and great cat, great drummer. Good folks there, Josh. And then first Thursdays. You know, this has been going on in Pedro a while.
Oh, the first Thursday.
I didn't know about it.
They DJed back at the Karma Studio.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, this is on 7th Street. Karma was on 6th, so this is like some art galleries and a guy that's having me care play 7th.
Yeah, the whole downtown's on his first Thursday.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
What an idiot. And I was making fun of the people who didn't know the kind little
you know, geography spots in Pedro. And I didn't know about this social thing. So, about time I learned. I didn't get to play. And then then I go away to France and Switzerland for some Stooges. So I write some diary for me to do there.
Cool.
Everybody, it's February 20, 2007. There's your Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.